Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Tuesday, December 19th, 2023. I'd like to thank you so much for tuning in. Appreciate your viewership over the years, or at least over the past year. And we're also very thankful that you're tuning into WVW TV, which is a really tremendous opportunity to get viewpoints into the great marketplace of ideas. WVW TV has been broadcasting since 2006. And as you know, we're not a commercial network. We don't sell ads to stay online, but we do have generous contributors such as yourself who basically would be able to make a donation at this time of giving at this end of the year season. And you can do that by going to the WVW Foundation, wvwfoundation.com, and making a donation, which helps defer the costs of keeping this broadcast network alive and putting really high quality content into the great marketplace of ideas. So if you're in that generous holiday gift giving mood and you're looking for someone to be generous to, please consider WVW TV. And in any event, thank you so much for continuing to watch our programming because really we do put out a different point of view on many, many topics. And all of these points of view belong in the great marketplace of ideas. And as a result, our voices are heard. So by supporting this network, you are supporting free speech in general and also giving us an opportunity to participate. We also have corporate sponsors, of course, and the corporate sponsor for my programming this year has been Swiss America Trading, which is a precious metals trading company in America. It's an American-based company in Arizona, and they provide, they offer precious metals. So if you're looking to add tangible precious metals to your portfolio, you can certainly give them a call at 1-800-519-6271 or go to their website, SwissAmerica.com. And if you use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, you can take a look around and see what they have to offer. They have a special, and it's December 19th, might be getting close to the deadline, but if you are still looking, like me, for some last minute gifts for certain friends and relatives, certainly look at their special right now, which is the Liberty standing half dollar silver coin, silver half dollar, and it's $13.50, and that includes free shipping, which is a big deal because precious metals tend to be heavy, and sometimes when you buy online, shipping costs can be prohibitive, but this is $13.50 each, free shipping. So you might want to order a few of them to hand them out to nieces and nephews and grandkids and aunts and uncles, whatever. They're great gifts. And when you give the gift of precious metals, it's a precious gift. It's not something that's consumed and thrown away and ends up in a landfill. These are things that will last forever because they're precious and they're long lived by in eons. Another interesting thing about giving the gift of precious metals is you can educate the gift receiver. It's great for children and grandchildren because what you want to do is show them that there are tangible assets that are valuable and retain their value because they're compared to our existing currency. And as we know, the currency in the United States is under some pressure at the moment from inflation and all. And by giving the gift of precious metals, you can make a statement, and you can also, it could be a teachable moment, I guess, to instruct those that, there are ways to preserve buying power through precious metals. What you see on the screen right now are the precious metals on their website, and the silver half dollar I'm talking about is a coin that looks like the one in the middle. We're looking at gold, silver, and platinum, and these are all minted by the U.S. Mint. That's a sense of comfort because when you're buying a precious metal coin, the question is how pure is the gold or silver or platinum and how much is there in the coin? And of course, if you're buying a half dollar silver dollar, you want to make sure it's the right amount of silver and the right amount of purity. And the same thing with gold. If you were to give somebody a gold coin for Christmas or for the holidays, That would be a real treasured gift, but you want to make sure it's all, the 1 ounce, the whole ounce is in there, and the purity. And that's why when you buy from a dealer like Swiss America, you can rest assured that these are U.S. Mint products and Swiss America selling, you know, high quality product. So it's something you want to think about. So get, you know, you can go to their website we're looking at right now, and SwissAmerica.com, and use the promo code Eastman, and you can take advantage of the specials and the sales, or give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. Tell them Dan Eastman sent you, and they'll be happy to honor that and send you some free information. So we'd like to thank Swiss America for their continuing support of WVW-TV. They've been a great partner over the years, and they'll be a great partner for you as well. Okay, let's jump into the news, and you'd kind of expect the week before Christmas to be a slower news day, and I'm still wrestling with my new technology, so I'm going to be taking my glasses on and off. I'll be very professorial about it, but in order to communicate, it helps to be able to see what I'm doing. So let's jump in. There's a little bit of news today, and it didn't take long. If you were listening yesterday, I announced, of course, I broadcast that Nippon Steel has made a tender offer for United States or U.S. Steel. That was big news, and of course, being somewhat long in tooth, I immediately knew that that was not going to be well received in certain hallways. And it didn't take long at all. But of course, the United Steelworkers Union is apoplectic about this, because they have something on the order of 11,000 members. And when a company is foreign owned, that makes bargaining a little bit more difficult. And anybody who's dealt with Japanese companies understands that their view of business is dramatically different than the United States view. Large corporations in Japan will have a 100-year horizon. In the United States, we do every 3 months. We're quarterly, okay? And Japan looks very differently at where to build a plant, when to keep a plant open, how to keep a plant open, labor relationships. If you know how the Japanese industrial bases come to the United States in the automobile manufacturing industry, the unions have had a bit of a rough row with that. So, of course, the United Steelworkers are running around all over, or at least the managers thereof are all over Washington today. And we're seeing first Democrat senators coming out of the box, and now Republican senators coming out of the box and saying that this may not be good for the United States. And as I had mentioned yesterday, it really raises some very, very troubling strategic questions with respect to the U.S. If you look at steel manufacturing globally, you realize that China makes a lot of steel, and there have been steel dumping issues where they dump cheap steel to force the price down and force the American steel makers out of business. And of course, Japan is just off the coast of China. And if you were to see the concentration of steel manufacturing in China and Japan in the Asian world, then it begs the question, if the United States needs to build things for its defense, like perhaps a tank or a gun or an airplane or whatever takes steel, or a railroad to move things around, would it be prudent to be beholden to the Asian world to defend the United States? And of course, Europe has got its own issues. So the question becomes whether that's a strategically wise move. And of course, there will be many who argue that in times of peace, Japanese manufacturing of steel would be superb. I mean, excellent. They're excellent manufacturers. And at the end of the day, in times of not so much peace, it becomes a strategic problem for the United States, because if you need steel to build tanks to go fight somebody over in Asia, that may be a problem to get raw materials when you're, one minute you're shooting at them and the next minute you're trying to buy steel. So that's a problem. And I think we're going to watch this story to see if that comes to pass. Now, I think from the Japanese perspective, again, being, they think in terms of Japan is not an aggressive country. And of course, they're looking at global markets, global development over 100-year, 200-year horizon. And they see this as a wise. They think in terms of Japan is not an aggressive country. Excuse me, I'm getting feedback here. From our perspective, there are strategic problems. And of course, because the United States is in the position of, for some reason, being the world's policeman running around the globe, this may be problematic. And I think if you play this to its political outcome, There are some real serious problems with this issue. The other side of the coin is the American steel manufacturing business struggles. It's not as cheap. You know, it costs more money, and steel is an input. It's not an end game. Nobody buys a bar of steel to look at it. You can buy a bar of gold to look at it and preserve your buying power, but if you buy a bar of steel, it becomes rather a boring commodity. So we'll watch this story. And it, like I said, it didn't take long. I figured within 24 hours, there'd be plenty of yelling in Washington, and yelling they are. So let's move on to the next story. Another interesting story I saw this morning is that when we talk about the housing situation in the United States, there's a couple of numbers that popped out. And keep in mind that housing statistics are always long-term and they're variable because of the lag time in buying a piece of land, subdividing it, putting in the improvements, getting the permitting, and then finally being able to put that first glorious shovel in the ground. It takes a long time. So we see monthly numbers in the housing business and the housing and real estate sector, but they tend to be very volatile because of that. And the number I saw today is that housing starts, again, were up 14%. They were up last month 14%, and they're up this month 14%. So I did a little digging into that because in a time where the housing market sits dead on its heels and it's been dormant, we continue to see new houses being built. And these are primarily single-family homes. The multifamily permits have collapsed, which is interesting because multifamily has always been a very contracyclical industry where they tend to be overbuilt and then it crashes and then it goes dormant for 20 years and then somebody starts building apartments again. And what we're seeing is multifamily is finally coming to a rest because it's been a big part of over the last couple of years building apartment buildings all over the place. Well, as we see housing start numbers are going up, we also see building permits are down of 2.5% month over month. So and that again explains that lag in housing. So next month or the month after, as building permits have gone down, we will see housing starts. And housing start is when the construction loan is issued and the first dollars are spent, and literally the shovel goes into the ground. And that's what we're looking at. So what we're seeing is that those who can build houses are building houses because there is such a pent-up demand in America right now for housing, single-family housing. And when you look at the delta between the existing mortgage rates and the new mortgage rates, and you realize that people who have homes with mortgages are not selling because they don't want to be caught, they can't afford to be caught, from a 2% mortgage to an 8% or 7% mortgage. So what has happened is existing stock is ground to a halt. And that's an entrepreneurial signal or a pricing signal within that market for building developers, or house developers, to continue building. And of course, we had talked earlier, I think this week or last week, about builders actually buying down the rates to move inventory. But as long as houses are moving and you got to keep your construction crews going, then of course, that's what happens is effectively those who can afford a 7% mortgage and they want to buy a house, and they're probably gambling after listening to the Fed last week that the rates may come down and they'll buy it and then they'll refinance lower and they'll be in a better place. There's still life in the housing market. But it you can see the entrepreneurial activity within that just by looking at the statistics. Well, the lead story today that led to that discussion is effectively that when you look at housing, existing homes being frozen up, not the new homes so much, but the existing homes. And keep in mind that the home building is a fraction of what it was, even though builders are building homes and, starts are going up 14% month over month, from a low base is still a low number. But what's happening is that this is having a ripple effect in other segments of the economy. And housing has traditionally been one of the prime, if not the prime driver of the domestic the GDP, because it is vast. It's not just a matter of somebody buys a house, they refurnish the house and they repaint the house inside and out. They buy new furnishings, they buy new curtains, they buy, perhaps they fix a few things, maybe do an addition, or they, you know, do some improvement. And what you're seeing is companies that are in home improvement or furniture or decorating or landscaping, their sales are off because there just isn't a lot of dynamics in the existing home market. And of course, the new home market is showing signs of a little bit of life here, at least according to these numbers. But when you build a brand new home, you're not redecorating. You just, it's brand new. So you might be buying furniture, but you're not, you know, painting the walls and fixing this and fixing that. So housing is definitely, you know, in a hurt zone at this point. And I think that's one of the big pressures on the Federal Reserve heading into an election year to cut rates. And unfortunately, there's another story about how, you know, the Fed's independence died last week. Well, it died back in the LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. That's for those of you born after 1964. Basically the same thing. And when the Fed reacts to political, then the critics come out. And basically what we're seeing is there's a strong possibility that we're going to end up with rate cuts in 2024, which of course will stimulate the housing market and everybody will be happy and the politicians will make advantage of that news. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But I do think that the higher for longer, basically the Fed's policy of higher for longer, which was turned on its head last week, Fed Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said that, you know, a couple of, like last month, that they would hold the rates where they are for longer than necessary to squeeze inflation. And then last week he pivoted, amazing pivot, and said, well, I'm thinking about cutting the rates. And then immediately the president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank came out and said, well, you know, we're not really talking about that. So it remains to be seen what happens. But when you think about it, there's a lot of pressure to cut interest rates in the United States, not only from the housing sector, which really touches the consumers, but there's also always the pressure on the federal debt. And there was an article that I read this morning, was quite interesting, is that when Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen goes out to refund debt that's maturing, and keep in mind, Professor Yellen, Secretary Yellen, is and former Fed Chair Yellen is very wise in the ways of money and monetary policy. I mean, she knows what she's doing. And of course, part of the strategy, if you're managing the portfolio of the federal debt, is that you basically have to refinance the debt, and you want to get to the lowest possible interest rate, because the interest is an additional cost to the federal budget. So when she's doing her job, and if you're the Secretary of the Treasury tomorrow, you wake up, you're blessed with such an opportunity, you will want to go shopping for money and the best deal on money, just like everyone else. And so what has happened is that when in the bond market, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, because bond trading is a very complex process. Very smart people are involved in very big computers with lots of horsepower. And there are all sorts of algorithms and metrics that are used to try and do one thing. If you're the lender, you want the highest amount of interest rate, because that's good for you. It's that rational economic thinking again. If you are the borrower, of course, you would want the lowest interest rate. That's what we see in the housing market. The housing market froze up when interest rates went from basically 2% to 8%, and buyers are rational beings, and they say, well, that's too much money. Well, it's the same thing with the Federal Treasury. Because they have, pick a number. It's when I started my show in March, it was $32 trillion. Now it's $33 trillion, soon to be $34 trillion, could be $35 trillion. It's a lot of money. And that is debt that is outstanding. And that's why I like to sort of poke fun at the economists who say, well, it's federal debt doesn't matter because you're borrowing from one pocket and putting it in the other. We're borrowing it for, or lending it to ourselves and borrowing it from ourselves. You're not. And you really have to stop and think about why people would say that. Obviously, the economists who say such things don't have a 401k that are holding federal treasuries, or else at least they're not aware of it. Because every last dollar of that $33 trillion or $34 trillion is owned by somebody on their asset on their balance sheet, that's their property. So if you have a $1,000bond from the federal government of the United States, you're not only expecting your $1,000 back at maturity, but you're also expecting the promised coupon rate of interest. And for you're not you didn't borrow that to yourself. You borrowed it to Uncle Sam. And Uncle Sam isn't going to pay itself back. It's going to pay you back. So the point is, when you're out as the Treasury Secretary shopping around for money, you have to basically find really good deals on money. And when you think about how finance works, I'm not sure of my audience, if you've all taken finance, you're all finance degrees, majors, and you're calling me out left and right, or you've never heard of such a thing. But there's a concept in finance that we call the time value of money. And if you think about it logically, if I come to you and say, would you lend me $100 for 1 year, please? And you say, oh, sure, Dan, I'll do that, but I want 8%, just like the mortgage guys get. And I say, okay, I'll give you the 8%. Well, then, at the end of the year, I give you, the $100 back and the 8%, and you're happy. I'm happy. Whatever I did with the money and paid the interest, I must have had some reason to borrow money and pay interest on it. But the point is that that's economic rationality. And if I came to you and said, I want to borrow that same, $100, but I'll pay back in 20 years. And you say, man, I don't know, you're kind of old and gray, and 20 years is a long time. Are you sure you're going to be around in 20 years? And I said, oh, of course, I take my vitamins, I'm healthy. There's more risk. So you're going to say, well, I'll lend it to you, but I want, for you, 15%, not 8%, because there's more risk, okay? Or if I say I want to borrow $100 for a year, but I'm going to take it to Vegas, and if I win, you get paid back, and if I lose, then we both lose. Well, then that interest rate is going to be like 50%, because that's like more of a partnership-y thing, or at least a joint venture. So the point is, the longer and the higher the risk, the more return investors want. And if so, on a short-term note, there's little risk, because a year, that's not so long. If you're young, that's nothing at all. But if it's a 10-year bond or a 20-year bond or a 30-year bond, there's a lot of risk. So the interest rates are higher the longer the money is on loan. Well, when you're the Treasury Secretary, of course, if you're Janet Yellen, you're smart. You know that because you took economics and finance 101 back in the day, and the time value of money. So if you have a gigantic $33 trillion in debt, and it's everything from a 3 month or 1 week T-bill or T-bill whatever, all the way up to a bond, if you start refinancing as these bonds are coming due, and they're at 2% or 1% or 1.75%, and now you're staring at a higher interest rate, you think, man, that's going to cost the Treasury more money in debt service. What you will do is you'll buy the shortest denomination you can buy, because it's the lowest interest rate in a higher interest rate world. And that's basically what the Treasury prudently does. I mean, that's kind of, we expect them to do, because there's what things are eternal. God is eternal. Taxes are eternal. Death is eternal, and the federal debt apparently is eternal too. So you're going to manage this monster prudently by buying shorter term instruments, and you as the Treasury Secretary are kind of gambling that interest rates will go down, and as these things are maturing, that you can lower the average cost of interest to the federal debt. And it's a whole strategy, and that's I'm trying to simplify a very complex strategy. By shifting your purchases to the short end, you can lower your interest costs, and then there's the gamble that the Fed will cut the interest rates. But because you're the federal treasury, you're in cahoots with the Federal Reserve, you may have some actual influence on the ability of the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, which means if you're trying to manage this increasing debt and the interest that comes along with it, there's a lot of political pressure on the Federal Reserve to lower the interest rates, not only for the housing market, but there's this out of control federal debt that is increasingly burdensome. When we talked a couple of weeks ago about how that debt is, that interest debt service is $1 trillion, and it's getting to be $1 trillion, and it's going to be bigger and bigger as interest rates stay higher. Because if you look at the average Brontosaurus curve of the federal debt, somewhere on that curve, there is an average or mean interest rate, okay? And that has crept up because every day the federal government is refinancing its debt. And that has been creeping up along with the Fed's raising of interest rates, the mortgage rates, and everything else. So what you're trying to do is move that needle back. And if you're the federal, government, you have the ability to communicate with the Federal Reserve, then that happens. So what it's telling us, we, me, somebody, is that you can expect to see from a political perspective, interest rate cuts, which will very much help the debt burden of the federal government. And of course, that'll help the housing market and stimulate the economy, and everybody will be happy, and they'll all vote for the incumbent, and life goes on. But the problem with doing that is that you're ending up with a situation where the tax base of the United States is rapidly approaching the point where it cannot support the debt and the spending. And that's why we're seeing an increase every, an increase in the deficit spending on a monthly basis. I mean, this used to be an annual budgety kind of thing, but it we're caught in that cyclone, basically. And that's why you want to the only possible outcome other than default, and nobody's talking about default. That's not going to happen. Nobody's going to default on federal debt. But what will happen is the least pain point, the point of least pain is inflation. And that's basically what'll happen. Cut the interest rates, housing market explode, prices explode. And all you have to do, if you're a history buff, is dig back into the 1970s and understand what happened. It was a very complicated time. Came out of the 1960s, which was a very complicated and violent time. We lost the president of the United States to assassination. We lost one of the greatest civil rights leader in American history to assassination. We lost the president's brother to assassination. I mean, these are violent times. And of course, you have the Vietnam War and all the rest of it. But when you look at the early 70s and how that war winds down, the guns and butter damage is done, the deficits are bulging, and America goes off a gold standard, which was set in the Bretton Woods conference after World War II, which was the stabilizing act that stabilized the world currencies. The whole thing comes unhinged, and the resulting inflation was stunning. And I have a magazine somewhere in my archives. I don't know where, it's stuffed up in the attic somewhere. It was a magazine that I think it was I can't remember if it was a Motor Trend. It was some magazine that had an ad for a Cadillac. Big, this is back in 1972. Let me tell you, Cadillacs were like 23 feet long and 10 feet wide, and they weighed, a million pounds, and they were like living rooms on wheels, okay? The Cadillac Sedan DeVille. And it was for sale for 30, I think $3,200. That was printed on the magazine. It was the back cover of this magazine. For $3,200, you could buy a gigantic Cadillac. Well, today, luxury Cadillac top of the line is, $90,000, $80,000. Now, obviously, it's not the same car. It's a vastly better car today than it was in 72. But the point is, from houses to a gallon of milk to a gallon of gas to a pair of shoes to a Cadillac Sedan DeVille, which they don't even make anymore, prices have gone up rather dramatically over one generation, maybe two generations, one lifetime. And that didn't just happen in a vacuum. It happened because of monetary policy and fiscal policy that were out of sync, and it was delinked from the tax base. And when that happens, inflation happens. So the point of this is that you want to be ready when inflation is, it's here now. It was here last year, 9%. It's allegedly here now at 4% core, maybe 3 point something, headline. But at the end of the day, when monetary policy and fiscal policy are where they're at, the only politically possible pathway is to inflate yourself out so that $33 trillion doesn't look like a lot of money. And believe me, that is going to be quite a ride. So what you'd really like to be doing is thinking about positioning yourself so that your assets are going along for the ride. A rising tide floats all boats. And if you have land, or you have a house, or you have, gold coins, or you have, collector art, or whatever asset turns you on, when the tide rises, your boat or raft or canoe or ship will float. And if you don't, you know, it's going to get real hard to stand on your tippy toes to stay above water, because inflation is something that once the genie's out of the bottle, it is not something you can stuff back in. Okay, well, thanks for listening. We're still working on my layout. I'm going to, you know, do a little more tweaking here, but it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. And please support WVW TV Foundation. It's really important to keep this message alive. And have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow. Take care. Bye.